Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution for the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org.
Hi, it's Alan Chartok, and it's the Capital Connection. Joining us this week, back in his old job as legislative director for the New York Public Interest Research Group, or NYPIRG, where he is and has been a living legend for quite a while, is Blair Horner. Welcome back, Blair. It's so good to see you back on that perch. You've been with the American Cancer Society for a while now and doing a great job there, but this is where you are needed. So what made you do it?
Well, you know, maybe I need my head examined. I mean, that's possible. You know, it's one of those things. I always tried to make my decisions in my life more or less based on what I found most interesting. And when I was looking ahead, coming up in the next few years, for example, New York State has a vote on a constitutional amendment on redistricting next year. In 2017, there'll be a vote on whether or not there's going to be a constitutional convention convened. And the idea of being on the sidelines for some of those discussions, I mean, on top of everything else that goes on. There'll be a debate on election reform, campaign finance reform. There'll be a debate on hydrofracking. I mean, there's lots of other issues. But those big ones, the constitutional ones, are coming down the pike. And I think I would go crazy having to be watching them from the side. So, you know, NYPIRG's a unique place. It gives me an unbelievable opportunity to be part of the discussions. And so I decided it was a good time to go back. It's sort of that sort of simple, and that's why maybe I do need my head examined.
Well, how do you make personal decisions? I know that once when I was in a great crisis and working for the legislature.
That'll do it.
I was working for Senator Orenstein at the time, and I turned around to my wife and I said, I can't stand this. I just can't stand it, but we really do need the money. I was making a lot of money, like $10,000 at the time, and it was just getting us over. And my wife said, quit. It's time to go. If you don't like it, quit. We'll make out. How did that happen in your case?
Well, it's similar, but I wasn't unhappy at the Cancer Society.
Yes.
That was the difference.
Of course not.
I was making a lot more money. You know, the work was interesting. The people were great. They worked very hard. The issues were interesting. The position itself had evolved more and more over time, though, into a management position, and I was doing less and less advocacy. And I knew that that was going to be the case when I went there because I was the vice president for advocacy. And, you know, on the scales, though, it was just tipping more and more to management. And that's happened to coincide at the time when I started to think about it. It all started, actually, I was on this bike ride across the state of New York in early July. And nothing quite like thinking about things when you're riding for hours on end with nothing else to do.
Were you alone?
Well, it was part of a trip put together by the Parks and Trails of New York State Group. And they had like 500 bicyclists. But a lot of the time, you're by yourself. And there's really nobody to talk to, especially when you're as sort of as a bicyclist like me. I was worried I'd drive off the road. So the combination of concentrating on avoiding broken glass and thinking about what I wanted to do with myself led me to the conclusion that, you know, I want to do something else. I want to go back. So it was like that. But, you know, it is a substantial cultural shift from a big, you know, billion-dollar enterprise like the American Cancer Society and little NYPIRG.
I take it you've had to take a little cut in your salary?
I took a, yes.
That's terrific. I mean, that really
Well, it's not terrific,
something.
But that part isn't.
It says something about you, Blair Horner. I guess I want to just sort of go to some of the substance of things that you're looking at. But first, I want to say that I'm old now. And when I got here to Albany, which is a lot of years ago, and began looking at the scene, NYPIRG was almost a joke. People would kid about it and say, you know, a bunch of guys sitting with a single light bulb over their head, you know. But now it's quite something. It is really the premier group, which, you know, is holding people's feet to the fire. How's it funded?
Well, if you looked at it, again, you know, I've been gone for a couple years, right? So there may be some shifts around the margins. But if you looked at it as a pie chart, roughly half of the revenues come in the form of small donations from individuals, roughly 60,000, 70,000 people across the state. Then of the remaining half of the pizza pie, if you look, it's basically thirds, third from foundations and grants and things like that, a third from various entrepreneurial projects that NYPIRG has, and then a third from colleges and universities across the state where the students have voted to join. And so that pie comes to roughly $5 million a year. And, you know, again, it may be a little bit, the percentages may be a little bit off in the last couple of years, but that's more or less the funding.
How it's done. Okay, so when you first sat down with me, you mentioned a couple of things that are coming up that you thought were important enough to get you back in the game. Let's go over them. First of all, let's talk about redistricting.
Yeah, I mean, next year, the legislature has passed twice a constitutional amendment to change the redistricting system in New York State. It was the result of a negotiation between the governor and the legislative leaders. That vote comes up. Once it's approved by two successive legislatures, it then goes to the public for approval. And that vote is scheduled to be a year from now, basically November of 2014, when the governor is up for re-election. And we have a problem with that. I mean, NYPERG opposed the redistricting so-called reform.
I was going to say it smelled a little.
Yeah, well, I mean,
the so-called reform.
You know, I was not involved in it, so I can't give you chapter and verse of all the various provisions. But when you look at it fundamentally, in New York State right now, there's a allowable 10% range in population from any state senate district, largest to smallest population in assembly, largest to smallest power, 10% difference. So in the state senate district, that's like 30,000 more people in the biggest district than in the smallest district in New York State. When you look at the congressional lines, they're basically zero difference in population. So why is it that New York allows gigantic population differences? They use the gigantic population differences, it's legal, to sort of reorganize the districts to give the Democrats in the assembly more of a majority than probably they would deserve on population alone, and certainly for the Senate Republican slash independent Democratic coalition to control the Senate. So they rig the game by these population differences. Now, you can't fix that statutorily. You can do some things to make the system better. You have to change the Constitution, because the state Constitution was written in the early 1900s, basically organizing it in such a way that towns were going to be protected in the Constitution more than cities. Towns in those days tended to be Republican. Cities in those days tend to be Democratic. It was a way to sort of engineer it to keep the Republicans in charge.
And have been ever since, with a couple of minor exceptions.
Well, for the state Senate, that's absolutely true.
Yes.
And so that just is fundamentally unfair if you believe in one person, one vote. That should not be the case, that you allow gigantic population differences. But because of these constitutional provisions in state constitution, you can't fix it. So when the governor negotiated the legislation with the legislature, he left all those provisions in. And so the new constitutional reform,
which
we'll be voting on next year, allows continued significant population differences. Instead of 10%, he negotiated it down to 6 if approved. So we think that that's a mistake. We think you should clear all of the underbrush out of there, go to one person, one vote, create a real independent commission. You know, the process for that right now is they're appointed by the legislature. They're continued more or less in that sort of pattern under the reform. All of that stuff we believe should change. And so we'll be involved in that discussion. Now, I can't tell you exactly what NYPERG is going to do because it's only day two for me on the job. But, you know, we're continuing to be opposed.
Yeah. You know, you raise an interesting issue here. The governor, when he ran for governor, announced that he would veto any reapportionment that didn't go to an outside group of either professors or whoever you're going to appoint, as other states have done, so that the principal players didn't get to draw their own districts. And then he didn't do what he said he was going to do. He in fact, didn't veto that bill, despite promising to do it. And as a result, the same old happened. And you worked for the governor at one point.
When he was Attorney General.
Right. So you have some insights into this man that maybe I don't. But what was up with that? Was it all phony from the beginning?
Well, you know, again, I wasn't there, right? So it's hard to know for sure. I wasn't involved in the conversations. My guess is, you know, the governor, like any governor, triages the issues that he cares most about.
Sure.
And I think when Governor Cuomo first got elected, I think the image he wanted to be viewed as among the members of the public is he's the guy who rolled up his sleeves and fixed the state government. After years of complete chaos and dysfunction, he was going to make it functional. And so I think on some of these reform issues, on the ethics bill, which was weak too, the ethics reform that he got enacted.
He created something called Jay Cope,
right,
which others are calling Jay Joke.
Some others are not happy with it. And it's structural problems that they agreed to. Now, it could be, the governor doesn't have unilateral power. He would rather try to get a budget done on time and to get his, let's say in this particular case, a property tax cap approved, if it would be willing to trade the veto that he said he would do on redistricting. So what happened in the redistricting deal was that the lousy current status quo was left in place, so the lines were drawn for the next 10 years under the current lousy system. And then the reform proposal, you know, you could argue maybe is better than the status quo, but it's not very good. And so my guess is he was triaging, that he focused on the things that he wanted to get done, that he was willing to fight for, and there were things that he just wasn't willing to fight for, and it turns out that redistricting was one of them.
Even though his number one, it seemed to be at least, his number one campaign promise that he was campaigning.
Well, you know, he put out a number of books, he put out a lot of things, you know, but again, I think he has, this is my view, I've not talked to him about it, that he wants to be viewed by the public as the guy who fixed things and got things done. Sort of like, you know, he likes cars. And I think he wants the sort of the mental image of the governor under the hood of government making it run better. And so I think he was willing to give up on some things where the implications for redistricting changes don't occur for 10 years.
Yeah, and in 10
and
years,
he won't be governor.
He won't be governor, and most of the guys who are in the legislature
won't
be there.
That's right. Although you and I will still be here.
We will. That's right. Okay, let's go to the next thing you were going to talk about, which is a constitutional convention. Now, my very good friend, Jerry Benjamin, Professor New Paltz, and a wonderful man, is always for constitutional conventions and change. I have been a doubter all along. I actually remember having worked in and around a constitutional convention many years ago. And it was
many years ago.
And it was a farce. It was a farce. The same old politicians got a hold of it. They took off one hat and they put on another hat.
They got paid for both.
Constitutional convention. They screwed it all up. And in the end, we got very little done as a result of that. And by the way, and then I guess the next time there was a deal that they were saying that they wouldn't run, but they had cronies who ran and they got these other guys to run. So I'm not a big fan fooling around with the state constitution, although it's an obsene document. It's filled with nonsense.
Right, like ski trails in the Adirondacks are in the Constitution.
Sure.
I mean, there's sort of crazy things in there.
No, it's crazy. The U.S. Constitution, as I last remember counting the words, was about 6,000 words, and this thing is just out of control.
It's like the telephone book.
It is. Okay, so then you get this thing, a constitutional convention. The polls jump on it. They all have their own thing. And it's doubtful that you're going to get anything done. And you spend millions and millions and millions of dollars getting it done.
Well, and possibly bad things could happen. I mean,
that's right.
Anytime you roll the dice, anything can happen. So just so your listeners know, every 20 years under the New York State Constitution, there's a vote put to the public as to whether or not they want to convene a constitutional convention. And if they convene it, the way it works is each state Senate district elects 3 delegates, and then there's 15 statewide people elected to the convention.
Now, let's remember, we'll take you back to what we just talked about, redistricting. Some of those state Senate districts are not too healthy to begin with.
I mean, and who else can run? Who else can take time off from their job to run to be a delegate? Right. I mean, there's going to be work involved. The criticism, though, the most legitimate criticism of the process of the Constitutional Convention is that elected officials are most likely the people to run, and a senator and 2 assembly members for each Senate district.
But even if they don't, even if they say that's wrong,
or their buddies.
My buddy Louis will run.
Right. But there's no restriction on who can run.
Yeah.
And they get paid as if they're state legislators. And I think the last time there was a convention, the president of the convention was the Speaker of the Assembly, who was able to get paid by both as a delegate and as a Speaker of the Assembly. So then the question is, what do you do about that? If you want to change the delegate selection process, you have to start now. And so that's one of the reasons why I even raised it. I think it's important, and I talk to my colleagues in the reform community about this as time plays out, is that we advance proposals to make the delegate selection process most likely to be one that where delegates would be elected from average people, that normal people would be able to run. So you'd have a system of public financing, for example.
Average for people, delegates. All those people who watch Prairie Home Companion.
Or anybody, right?
Or
I mean,
children.
Like the people who elect the president of the United States.
How do you do that?
Well, you have to change the delegate selection process.
Well, give me an idea of how you might do that.
Well, I mentioned one example just now. You'd have public financing so that, let's say, a Blair Horner who lives in Duanesburg, New York, who doesn't have personal wealth, has never been elected official, and I'm not even enrolled in a political party. I would be able to run as a delegate if there was public financing. I would not be able to seriously run if there is not.
Well, so a pig just flew through the room. in other words, when pigs fly.
I was wondering what that was.
When pigs fly, you know, these guys, they're never going to change the rules if they can help it. Well, they don't like public financing. I know the Assembly passes public financing bills, but that's because they know the Republicans aren't going to do it. And they got there under the old rules. So why do they change the rules so Blair Horner can do it and not Louis, the guy's second cousin?
No, I mean, and then maybe they won't, right? But then that's the, at least the public, when they go to vote on whether or not there's going to be a Constitution Convention, the issue of how the delegates would be elected will be debated in advance. And if the public doesn't like that process, they'll vote down the convention. They won't do it. If the process has been reformed, maybe they'll want to do it, right? But you can't wait until 2016 to make that happen. You have to start advancing the proposals in 2014, make it an issue in the governor's race, let the gubernatorial candidate say, what are they going to do to have a people's convention as compared to a Paul's convention? And then let's see if we can have a debate on that and make it happen. If it doesn't happen, it doesn't happen.
Wait a second. Let me just get this straight. Was that the same governor who said that he was going to veto any bill that was not
that
a fair apportionment? Yeah, so he says it. So,
well,
okay.
Then the bills don't pass, right? I mean, at the end of the day, though, instead of the public not knowing what's happening, voting one way or another based on whatever fear campaigns are mounted, which there will be, there will have been a democratic process opportunity to fix the Constitutional Convention process in advance. If it fails, that helps make the case not to do one.
Sure. Well, quite right. Now, let's talk a little bit about one of your pet issues, and that's transparency in state government. I know when you mentioned before that you had gone to do a little job for the governor, now then the attorney general.
That's right.
He was interested in transparency and creating a transparent system. I'm going to tell you right now, I don't think this governor is particularly transparent, despite the fact that he hired John in the old days to do that.
Well, I was working at the attorney general's office.
And the attorney
general. Get hired at the governor's office.
Yes, yeah. But character is character, and, you know, things don't change.
You know, this governor is, in aspects of what he does, is as secretive as any other governor that we've seen in modern times.
Do you think?
Yeah. And that there are other areas, though, where he's open. And I think there's
like, can you name some of the ones that he's open that you're proud of?
Let me make a distinction. I think there's a distinction in the governor's mind. Again, this is just my guessing, between the process of governmental decision-making and access to government information. So, for example, he has done a number of things, and the project I worked on at the Attorney General's office was to bring new technologies to bear on governmental data so that the public would have easier access to it.
For example?
Well, what I worked on was the thing called Project Sunlight, which was to create a database where the public would be able to simultaneously search for lobbying funding, the introductions of bills, campaign contributions, government contracts, et cetera. You could look at that in one place. The governor has done similar things with this Open New York order he put out, which forces the agencies to make their databases more available. So if you go to the health department website, for example, information you would be able to normally get under FOIL is now posted on
FOIL,
the website.
FOIL, that's it when you ask
Freedom
the
of
government.
Information
yeah,
law. Right. Right, so that the public access. So now they just make it available, and they make it available in Excel spreadsheets where you can look at nursing home complaints, for example, in a relatively easy way. So I think that's an area that he views sort of like, these are not his words, it'd be mine, sort of a digital democracy where you can actually make government information available through new technologies. On the process of this making decisions, he negotiates budgets in secret. He negotiates his big bills in secret. But that's not any different than most of the other governors. So those
Three wrongs don't make a right.
No, I'm not saying it's right. Nyperg's view would be that that's wrong. Nyperg complained even about the SAFE Act, the way that the passage
gun,
was done,
the gun control
legislation. But I think that's the distinction he makes, that he would rather negotiate in secret, hammer deals out, make it happen quickly so his opponents have no time to react, because he views that as a tactical advantage for himself. We think that it leads to worse public policy, because when you negotiate things in secret, more mistakes get made because you're not bringing to bear everybody who's involved in it.
On the other hand, and I don't like to give the other hand and give him a helping hand, on the other hand, I have a feeling that unless he had operated under the so-called message of necessity, we might not have a gun bill in New York State right now.
That may well be true. The forces opposed to it would have mobilized and acted against the legislation, made it hard for the bill to pass. But again, that's a tactical decision he makes. The ramifications are that he runs an administration which is much more secretive than we believe it should be, because after all, the government is by the people. And if the people don't know what's going on, I mean, the whole basis of democracy is that the public gives their informed consent to the representatives to make decisions. How can you give informed consent if you don't have information? So that has to change.
Yeah. There is a goo-goo community, we call it, in a good government community in Albany. You have some of the same old mm-hmm. People. Many of the faces haven't changed since you were here the last time. Is there a way to organize all those so-called goo-goo groups, good government groups, so that their clout is increased because they are cooperating?
Well, it hinges on the institutional interests of the groups. I mean, you see this in a lot of groups. The environmental community doesn't always act as one, and to some extent that's because there are institutional conflicts that occur. Sometimes it's personal between people that are involved in issues. Sometimes it's institutional. To circumvent or, you know, somehow deal with that, you have to change that dynamic. The good government community over the years that I've been involved in it, which is like 30 years now, tends to be more likely to work together than not, but doesn't always work together. In recent years, it's been less likely to work together. And some of that are policy differences, and some of that are, you know, institutional.
Well, I've conflicts. Always wondered, for example, I've always liked Barbara Bartoletti at mm-hmm. the League of Women Voters. She's been around for a long time, too. But I always think that sometimes when they sign on to something that I wouldn't have signed on to, it's in order to get a half a loaf and to be able to say, well, see what we accomplished, group, to their own members. It scares me.
Well,
and by the way, I'm not singling her out because I frankly don't know what that's about. But yes.
Well, I mean, that's always the problem of any advocate, right? You never get what you want. But as that famous British philosopher Mick Jagger says, do you get what you need?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so what is, you know, are you improving on the status quo or you're not? I mean, none of us have the kinds
by an inch. Is it worth it to improve on it by half an inch or centimeter as opposed to
example,
really making major
A good example is the League, as I understand it, and other groups, I think Citizens Union, supported the redistricting reform.
That's right.
And Nyberg did not.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there are sometimes policy differences, and that's okay. I mean, that happens, right? But there's a good example, a case study where the groups did not agree on how many slices of the loaf were enough to feed them. And sometimes you do. But when you're an advocate, you're usually in a situation of deciding at the end of the day, is this enough of an improvement over the status quo that it's worth supporting?
Well, Blair Horner, this will be the first of many times, I am sure, that you're back talking to us, if you'll come back.
Anytime.
Our guest has been the magnificent Blair Horner. We are so glad he's back in the saddle. Legislative Director for New York Public Interest Research Group, NYPIRG. Blair, again, thanks for doing all of this at some sacrifice to yourself, and we'll be talking to you soon.
Thanks for having me.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org, and NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decision to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.